Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Perhaps you've seen this video compilation created by the Deadspin website for its news, politics, and culture section called The Concourse. In it, local television news anchors from around the country read the same script.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and
false news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
These hosts are all reading a script that was sent down from the large media conglomerate that owns them, Sinclair Broadcast Group, and the language was given to the stations as a must-read script, one that anchors were supposed to deliver in person to their audience in prime time. There's been a lot of backlash to that message, partly because Sinclair often does not present unbiased, accurate news, and it has caused people to feel even more distrust of the media. But that's not the only reason many Americans are hesitant to trust what they hear and read in the news. Today on the program, we're going to look at the levels of trust people have for the media, specifically the news media, and how it affects our democracy and the choices we make. We're joined today by David Motes, author and former editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald and the Barry Montpelier Times Argus. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his series of editorials on civil unions legislation. He's also an occasional commentator for VPR. David, it's a pleasure to have you here with us.
Happy to be here with you, Jane.
We are also joined by Brendan Nyhan, a professor of government at Dartmouth College who studies politics and media. He's one of the authors of a Poynter Media Trust survey that was released, that was released in December. Brendan, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Brendan, could you help paint a picture of the media landscape as you see it these days, including things like consolidation and smaller news budgets?
Sure. We've seen a transformation of the media that's still ongoing, but I think it's having important effects already on how people get their news and how they feel about it. There's a much greater emphasis on the national news, and we've seen a kind of corresponding decrease in local news budgets and consumption. Now, part of that's about the changing economics of the media, right? It's unfortunately the print media world has found its business model to be under threat. That's decimated local newsrooms across the country. We've seen a hollowing out of local newspapers all the way up to major metropolitan dailies, which were until recently quite healthy and employed hundreds of reporters in some cases. But now we're seeing dramatic scale backs, right? So even though the national media is thriving in some ways, you know, the New York Times and Washington Post have never been more relevant. They're winning Pulitzer Prizes as they did yesterday. They attract subscribers across the country. They're transitioning to digital business models. But local and state media are really struggling, and I think that poses important challenges for democratic accountability in this country.
David Motes, you've experienced this firsthand recently when you perhaps entered retirement a little earlier than expected because your position was eliminated from the papers that you worked for. So what do you think the value is in having robust local newsrooms, given that people can get their information directly from the sources? You can go to a town clerk's website. You can read up on what your politicians are doing based on the press releases they put out. So why does it matter if we are losing local news staff?
Local newspapers and broadcast outlets are part of the community, and if they have a sense of responsibility, people learn to respect them even when they disagree with them. If they are there long term over the years working in the community to provide the news, then there's accountability, and there's people see in their newspaper a reflection of the community, whether it's, you know, seeing their kid's name in the sports section or reading coverage of the Board of Aldermen. And that's important. People still want the news. it's the economic changes have made it harder for them made it harder for local outlets to staff up so that they can provide it. You see it in a time of crisis. Whether it's a big crisis, at 9/11, 9/12, I happened to be at Penn Station in New York City, and the newspapers were stacked almost to the ceiling. People wanted to know what the New York Times had, and if there's a fire in Rutland, they want to know instantly from a local source what's happening. It's vital to a community to have that kind of coverage. And what's suffering in all across the country in particular is state house coverage. The Rutland Herald and Times Argus and the Free Press, everybody's had to scale back just because of economics. And but what coverage has done over the years in Vermont helped create a sense of Vermont as a whole, as a community. And that's important. We talk about Vermont values and Vermont this and Vermont that. Well, where do we get those ideas? It's from those values reflected day in and day out in news coverage.
David just mentioned 9/11 and that hunger for news after 9/11. And I think we may be in a similar moment in some ways right now, Brendan. I mean, we've certainly seen since the election in 2016, many newspapers are reporting increased subscription rates. Some of them are finding digital subscription rates have been going up or contributions that they've been asking for from readers. VPR has noticed an uptick in the number of weekly listeners. Do you think this is a momentary blip or actually a good sign for the state of the news media?
That's an interesting question. I'm not certain it's likely to be a sustainable long-term solution, and I would worry about propping up the media by creating a sense of political crisis. That's probably not a great thing for our democracy in the long run, and I do think that's what's motivating a lot of this consumption. The underlying problem here is I think the media's resurgence, such as it is, has been driven by, to put it bluntly, liberal fears about the Trump administration. And that means it's a very partisan sort of resurgence. And it's bad for a small D democratic society like ours to have the media be closely associated with one political party. I mean, as David mentioned, the media, should earn the respect of both parties and be perceived as legitimate by both parties. But what we've seen, at least at the national level, is a very sharp divergence in trust in the media between Democrats and Republicans. That's been true for a long time, of course, but that my co-authors and I actually find in that survey you mentioned that partisan polarization and trust in the media has widened since 9/11. And that's really been driven by Democrats increasing their reported trust in the media. So the gap is exceptionally wide right now. So it's great to see some people embracing the value of the media, but we really need a bipartisan consensus on its value and its legitimacy, its place in a democratic society. I worry we're not there, and that the cues people are getting too often suggest that the media don't have a rightful place in the conversation, are intentionally spreading misinformation, and so forth. The media aren't perfect. They make mistakes all the time, but their place in democratic society is an essential one. And again, maintaining that bipartisan consensus on that media, the role of the media as a small D democratic institution, is essential.
And Brendan, you mentioned this divide that goes down party lines between people who say they have trust in what the news media in particular is presenting to them and those who don't. Can you give us some of the statistics that were found in that Poynter survey? Something like 74% of Republicans say they believe the media makes up stories about the president.
That's right. That's right. It's important to be clear that this goes beyond simply thinking the media tends to have a liberal bias or liberal slant into more worrisome perceptions of the media itself. Right. So we see in our data, for instance, that more than 60% of people who approve of President Trump's job performance in office agreed that the media is an enemy of the American people and that the media keep political leaders from doing their job. And those are worrisome sorts of anti-democratic attitudes. Over 40% of Trump approvers even indicate support for the government being able to block the publication of news stories, which would be a violation of the First Amendment. Only about a quarter of Americans indicate support for that kind of an anti-democratic move overall, but 42% of Trump supporters. So it's not a majority, but worryingly close. And this is where elite responsibility is essential. People, the norms of our democratic society depend on elites giving cues to people about where these lines are, and saying, even if I don't agree with the media, even if they frustrate me, they have a legitimate place here, and we should respect their role. And when people don't hear those cues, these sorts of anti-democratic attitudes towards the media may become more widespread, and that's a very worrisome trend.
What do you hear when you hear those statistics, David Motes?
I worked all my career in newspapers in Vermont, and so I've basically been community based, and I think a lot of the distrust arises from the prominence of cable TV and the I think there's partly a cultural divide in that when you turn on the tube and you see national correspondents and national anchor people, they are urban, they're cosmopolitan, they're speaking in a certain way, and people across rural America, for example, may feel somewhat alienated, and they may feel that how dare they challenge our leader? I think there's a cultural schism there that feeds into this.
And you see it as an urban-rural schism in part.
Well, partly, I also am unclear that. I'm not sure how much people really understand and appreciate the professionalism of most journalists who are actually out there just trying to find out what's happening. And their opinions don't enter into it. This happens, on the staff of the New York Times and at weekly papers in Vermont. They're just trying to do the job and to provide information, sometimes about tough issues. And that sort of function is really at the heart of what we think of as news. And it gets drowned out by all the raucous voices that we constantly hear on cable news.
Brendan Nyhan, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, no, I think the culture gap is a real problem. There certainly are newsrooms that are farther from their community demographically than we might like. As journalism professionalized, there, especially at the national level, it started to overrepresent a certain kind of demographic that it hadn't in the past. And so you just get a lot of highly educated coastal elites, right? And there aren't that many people who are, for instance, who identify as Republican or conservative, or who identify as religious, and so forth. I do think that is a real problem, and it's one that newsrooms are trying to grapple with. I'm not sure people have figured out the solution, though. It's become a kind of running joke how people are sending out reporters since the election to find Trump voters and explain them to everyone else, right? And those stories are a kind of weird format where it's like they're visiting a foreign country, and they're all kind of cliched, and I don't think capture the nuance of what's going on out there either. So I do think there's a problem. At the same time, I really do want to emphasize something essential, which is, those culture gaps, while real, don't necessarily translate into the more extreme kinds of anti-media sentiment that President Trump has been mobilizing, right? It's possible that there's fertile ground out there because people don't feel like the media speaks for or to them. That's absolutely true. But at the same time, we have to be aware that this sentiment is being mobilized by a specific political elite who is telling people the media is fake news. Right, and the media is lying to you, and the media doesn't have your best interests at heart, and the media doesn't care about you, right? And those we know from decades of research in social science that those cues are very powerful. And I worry that all the real problems in the media, which we should address, it may seem like the cause of this distrust. But you know, in terms of what's happening right now, the thing that's changed most dramatically is the set of messages people are getting about the media. And that's where we need to do better, right? And where we need stakeholders on both sides of the aisle to say, we need the media as an independent knowledge-producing institution in our society. We all depend on accurate information. We all depend on holding elites accountable. You know, we should worry about these localities and states where the media aren't watching very closely what's happening anymore. You know, my profession, I think we would tend to believe that there's actually more corruption to expose at the local and state level typically than at the national level, where the scrutiny is very intense. And that's precisely where, you know, the watchman is asleep or not on the job, right? Because those reporters, you know, aren't in place anymore. So, you know, the media has a really important job to do right now at all levels. And, I want to, you know, emphasize how important it is that everybody, you know, shares that interest in it playing that role.
Well, and to the point about people going, you know, jumping into communities and from an outsider's perspective saying, look at these strange people who, for example, voted for President Trump. It strikes me that some of that could be solved by local robust reporting where the reporters actually live in those communities. So it's less of an outsider perspective and more of a, I'm just presenting you what this community looks like because I know it so well that I'm not taking it from a stereotypical point of view. I'm explaining it rather than sort of stereotyping it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was an initiative announced this week to kind of do a Teach for America version of local reporting where you send out young college graduates to work as reporters. And on the one hand, that may be an innovative way to get people into journalism and to fund journalism, which is hard to support right now. But you can certainly imagine it falling victim to exactly that problem you described, parachuting people in who don't know the community and haven't established a context in which to make sense of what they're seeing.
Dan is on the line with us from Newfane. Hi, Dan. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There are a couple points I'd like to just quickly make. One is this, as much as I abhor, you know, fake news on Facebook and, you know, the new sort of iteration of fake news as we're talking about it, we tend to forget that our august and well-established news organizations have engaged in some many bad practices, and we tend to forget about the ramifications of those. I'm thinking particularly the New York Times, when Judith Miller used a single source, who was a known perjurer, Adam Chalabi, to justify the claims about weapons of mass destruction. That reporting on the New York Times, you might argue, single-handedly brought the liberal establishment over to George Bush's side when he wanted to create that war in Iraq. And that was absolutely false news. It was false reporting, and Adam Shalaby just took the New York Times for a ride. Follow that with Jason Blair's reporting, which was genuinely false. He just made up stuff for a while until they caught him. And I combine that with back in the invasion of Panama when Radio Havana Cuba, after an embargo on the Cuban embassy, reported on day two about missile bomb strikes that killed 300 civilians and mass graves. And none of the American embedded reporters were able to find that mass grave until 3 weeks later. And I read about it in the New York Times. So these are really serious mistakes that led to, you know, very grave reactions and things that happened as a result, which we can't just pretend that didn't happen.
Well, so, Dan, you're right. We can't pretend that didn't happen. Is there a difference to you between an organization that, you know, granted, these were not honest mistakes in some of the cases, but they were then corrected by the organization that had published them? Does that make a difference to you when there is a correction or an attempt to get the truth versus an organization that is intentionally putting out false news stories and intentionally trying to mislead and not correct?
Yes, Absolutely, it makes a difference if an organization is able to own up to it. But what we seem to gloss and sweep under the rug is that makes a very big impression on people. So when Trump is ragging on the New York Times, I don't know if Trump followers are thinking of these instances, but the New York Times has done enough to damage its own reputation, and it hasn't. Even though it makes these corrections, as in most institutions, the corrections never really go deep enough to say why. How were we taken by Adam Chalabi? Why are we always willing to sort of report the government's point of view with less hesitation than we are to report the opposition's point of view? I mean, those are serious questions that August news organizations need to ask, and I don't think they're asking themselves those questions.
Well, Dan, I appreciate you bringing that perspective into the conversation, and Brendan Nyhan, I'm interested to hear what you think.
Well, it's an interesting question. I would say that there are very few media errors that move the needle on how the public feels about the press overall. They're simply not salient to everyday people who don't follow politics very closely. Even the most high-profile examples are only known to a subset of the most knowledgeable people, and those people tend to be the ones who have the most fixed attitudes, right? They tend to be the most polarized. And so it's harder to move their levels of trust, I would say. So I'm not sure that explains the distrust we observe. It doesn't mean those mistakes aren't consequential, and it doesn't mean that politicians, you know, in the real world, right? Obviously, they can affect policy or particular controversies or institutions that are being covered incorrectly, and it doesn't mean you know, that they shouldn't do better. But I would say, as a kind of bottom line, that doesn't seem to be a fundamental cause. And to give you some evidence of that, in our study that we mentioned earlier, this survey, we actually gave people a mock news article in which describing an error that CNN made in its coverage of the Trump-Russia investigation, a real error where CNN retracted a story and people eventually lost their jobs. And even a reminder of that error did not significantly change their expressed attitudes toward the media when asked immediately after finding out about this major error that CNN made. Again, people lost their jobs. This is a quite unusual error. So my instinct is to say, of course, the media should do better. Of course, those cases are worrisome. But I don't think they're the reason people distrust the media. I think people cite them when they're consistent with their perspective on the media. And the important point that you made is that the difference between real journalistic organizations and advocates or fake news purveyors is that real journalistic organizations, own up to their failures. You know, however imperfectly, there is a mechanism for that kind of accountability.
We got a note from Pat in Rutland who says, the larger issue, I think, is what happens when we lose trust in our leaders, our media, and each other. What happens when we don't know what is true, when we feel our fellow citizens don't know what is true? It eats the very heart and soul of a community, state, and country. And how do we get it back? Mark says, would not a reasonable person assume that when politicians and people in power throw shade at the media and accuse them of being fake, that it would incentivize reporters, journalists, and investigators to dig deeper and harder to uncover all the shady, underhanded, immoral, and possibly illegal things these same people have done and may still do? David Motz, sure, wouldn't it? I mean, yes, that would incentivize the media, but not if they don't have the staff and the budget to do it.
We need resources. We need people out there asking questions. I think newspapers and news outlets, their credibility is their greatest asset. And when mistakes occur, news people abhor mistakes, and they have to own up to them. They have to guard their credibility, and that's a continuing, ongoing thing. Rutland Herald and Times Argus had someone 10, 15 years ago who was making up stories, and it was appalling. We were all appalled, and the guy lost his job. We owned up to it in the paper. It happens. And VT Digger has a slogan news in pursuit of truth. I like that slogan because it doesn't suggest that here is the definitive truth. We're always pursuing it. You know, we're pursuing the news because it'll get us towards the truth, and it's an ongoing process. It's always a struggle, and you always know that there's more to the story, and good reporters are always trying to go after it.
We got a note from Dave who says, media bias is so bad now that I have been having to check several different sites to get a balanced view of many issues. I have found at times that even Breitbart sometimes gives a more balanced perspective than the New York Times. The Washington Examiner is also a good place to go to balance against the left-wing perspective of many media organizations. Brendan Nyhan, in some ways, having a balanced media diet or checking different biases against each other is a really good thing. But what does Dave's post tell you about, you know, his level of trust in certain organizations?
Well, let me say two things. I would worry about the difference between organizations that tend to have a different kind of slant and differing levels of commitment to journalistic norms and accuracy. Right? I would worry about a site like Breitbart, while perhaps providing a counterpoint to sites that the listener sees as more liberal, that Breitbart, unfortunately, is often a outlet for misinformation. And obviously, there are counterparts on the left one could find, too. But I would just say that balance in and of itself isn't necessarily a way to find accurate information. And we should be careful about conflating ideological balance with the pursuit of truth. You know, no side has a monopoly on truth, of course, but at the same time, it's not necessarily clear that mixing two kinds of sources on a particular issue is going to make you more informed. I mean, hopefully it will on average, but you should be cautious about the sources you find online. The broader point here, though, that we could talk about is the way people choose the sources they consult. And this is something that we talk a lot about now when it comes to the media. Are people seeking out balanced information diets in the way that the listener suggests that that he or she is? The research that I've done with my co-author suggests that the number of people who are actually in so-called echo chambers of like-minded news sources, that they're overwhelmingly consulting news from one side of the political aisle, is actually more rare than people think. Right? It's a relatively small subset of people. But those people who do have more skewed information diets are also the ones who consume the most political news. And so they're overrepresented in the audience for political news, which includes shows like this. And they're overrepresented potentially in the number of people who vote, who participate, especially in low turnout elections like primaries, who write letters to Congress, you know, all those different higher levels of civic and political engagement. So it doesn't seem like you know, the kind of balanced information diet that the listener is suggesting is as uncommon as people might think, but it may be most uncommon in the people who are most likely to participate in politics.
Let's go to Corby in Montpelier. Hey, Corby, go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I echo everything that I'm sorry, Brendan, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Just said. But as far as the echo chamber is concerned, I'm concerned that as people become more and more attuned to just their style of news, it's very similar in effect to like a cult leader. You know, when you've got the left, the right wing saying, you know, saying that the mainstream media is all fake news, it's kind of like a cult leader saying you can't listen to people from outside of our religion. Because if you do, they are evil. They are wrong. They are deadly. And my concern is how do we deprogram our own citizens?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Corby. What do you think, David Motes?
Well, I think it's true. You have to. People have to be encouraged to think and for themselves. And I think. You know, Vermont is a interesting case in point. I have friends out of state who referred to Vermont as an Obama bubble, and it's also a Sanders bubble. You know, the friends out of state who were Hillary Clinton supporters in the Democratic primary, you know, in Vermont, you know, Vermonters sometimes have to challenge themselves to you know, even on the liberal side, to look outside their bubble.
You know, one of the things, though, that Corby is getting us to is, okay, so what happens next? What should journalists and journalism as a whole and the news media do to try to regain that trust or to be more worthy of that trust? Brendan, you must have thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a hard one. You know, I'm not – the media are vulnerable to being politicized in the ways we've talked about, and when they try to counter that, it can often be ineffective or worse. Let me give you an example. One thing that I've been very critical of is the way the media retreated into the false balance of he said, she said reporting when it came to matters of fact. That was a way to avoid taking a stand on controversial issues, which is perfectly appropriate when it comes to matters of opinion. Of course, a news reporter shouldn't tell the audience which party is right. That's not their role. But when it comes to matters of fact, of course, that is their role. As journalists, that's what they're supposed to be doing, is helping adjudicate the evidence. And I worry that in this politicized landscape, the instinct will be to pull back further. Now, we also have to worry about the other extreme, which is media going too far and embracing a role as a kind of advocate that may cause people to tune them out, right? So it's this very careful balance where you have to be unafraid to to speak the truth about the facts as you understand them, while also being as neutral as possible on the underlying politics. Someone who's done that quite well is Jake Tapper, who was the Dartmouth commencement speaker last year and has attracted a lot of attention for how ruthlessly he grills people from both parties on his CNN show. And he's been able to do that and maintain that reputation despite being very critical of the Trump administration when they are misleading people or taking liberties with the truth. So I think there are models that we can find out there for how to kind of square the circle. But it's going to be a very delicate time for the media, and I think a lot of people are just going to try to stay out of the crossfire, which is unfortunately maybe not the best way to do the kind of journalism that we would hope they would aspire to.
For my part, I would say one of the things that I have found that I appreciate in reporting that I read, and especially because so much of it is digital now, is you can annotate your sources. You can actually very transparently say, this is how I have come to the conclusions that I have reached. This is not a false equivalency, but here's how I got here. Be very transparent in the reporting and in your sourcing, and maybe that helps earn the trust. But David Motz, one of the other things that I'm seeing that is troubling is that often op-eds are now sort of blended into news coverage or less clearly defined online. It's sometimes difficult for me reading something to I have to go back and say, wait a minute, is this an opinion piece or is this news? It does seem like a blurring.
Online, it is sometimes more confusing because it's just there on the screen. You know, in a newspaper, you have your op-ed and editorial pages, and it's quite separate. And you have to pay attention. The sites, you know, label things as perspective or analysis or this or that. This is where media literacy comes in.
Yeah, and perhaps we all need to be a little more literate and a little more cautious and careful and do a little bit more research ourselves if we're going to be thoughtful consumers of the news media. David Motz, author, former editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald and Barry Montpelier Times Argus, Pulitzer Prize winner and VPR commentator, thanks for talking with us
today.
Thank
you, Jane.
And Brendan Nyhan is a professor of government at Dartmouth College. He studies politics and media. He's one of the authors of the Poynter Media Trust Survey that was released in December, and we have a link to it at vpr.net. Brendan, thanks very much to you.
Thank you.